Hi, there it is. So now we are on and popping. As everyone knows, it is the last week of 2021's Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. We've been thrilled and honored at White Whale, as I said before, to get to help Joan and Chris host this year's online series. And though we're sad to see it close, it means we're that much closer to heading back to Hems. Want to say thank you to everyone for joining us all summer. The community has been amazing, as well as joining us for tonight's awesome lineup. There we go. We'll be hearing from our poets today. We'll be hearing from Veronica Corpus, Richard Gigek, Monica Prince, Stan Shapiro, and Lawrence Ray. So if you don't already know who's reading today, that's exactly who's reading. Once again, a little bit more about me. I'm Taylor, the events coordinator at White Whale Bookstore. We are a family-owned, general interest independent store located in the Bloomfield neighborhood in Pittsburgh, if you haven't already visited us. I don't know if anybody's had a chance to step in the store, but we're actually expanding. So if you haven't had a chance to come in, you'll see that we have like an entire other storefront coming next door. So you definitely have to come through. We've had like a handful of really good virtual events and readings and conversations lined up for the month of August. But we're open for browsing as well as like curbside pickup and shipping. So stay tuned for fall events. Stay tuned for whether or not they'll be in person as well. But you can always check our website, which I'll talk about a little bit further so that you all know what we're doing. But you can also keep up with which workshops plus several great launches and readings that we have back in the store. So you can find out about all these things at whitewhalebookstore.com. I'll make sure to drop the link in the chat so everyone can see. That's us. On August 18th, just a couple of events that are coming up. At 7 p.m., we're excited to host essayist Barrett Swanson, author of Lost in Summerland, and Jesse McCarthy, author of Who Will Pay Reparations or My Soul in Conversation. On the 20th at the same time, we're having an event dream come true. Not only are we honored to celebrate the paperback release of Shannon Reed's Why Did I Get a B, but we get to host our fellow Pittsburgh bookslinger in arms, Arlen Hess of City Books. And on August 21st, we can't wait to virtually welcome back the Laser Cat reading series this August, featuring Dorina Pena, Angela Gaito Laganese, and Diane Kerr. You can find out more about these events as well as RSVP for all the events using that link I just put in the chat. So some notes really quick on housekeeping for Zoom. We'll keep your video and audio off for the duration of the event so that it's easier to just focus on the writers. We'll also have a moment at the end that you all can turn your video on and we can applaud, say our well wishes, say hello. So make sure to stick around to the end if you want to participate in that portion. The chat in the Zoom meeting will be activated only for you to message the host. So you won't be able to message other users or to post publicly. But I will send the chat log to our readers along with the other Zoom files. So if you want to send them nice notes or kind thoughts, you can send them to me. For your best viewing, we recommend hiding non-video participants, which means hiding all the black boxes. Either click on view in the upper right-hand corner of the video section of the screen and click hide non-video participants, or right-click on your own black box and do the same. I'm going to copy this as well and drop this in the chat so you all can have the best viewing experience. And as you all can see, we do have closed captioning available. So you can toggle it on and off by clicking the CC button at the bottom of your screen. But without further ado, I want to make sure that we get started with the reading. So I want to go ahead and turn it over to Chris to kick us off for the last time this summer. OMG. And then I'll get us started off with our reading order. So thank y'all so much. And shout out to Chris.
Hi. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Thank you so much to Taylor. Couldn't do this without Taylor joining in and making sure that this all runs smoothly, because I don't think Joan or I could make that happen with the technology box that's in front of us here. We're used to bars and spilled beer. So it's good that we have the help. So thanks again. We couldn't have done this season without White Whale. I've said that in every installment, and it's because it's true. This season would not exist if White Whale hadn't really come to the rescue and partnered up with us to do this season. So we're very thankful for them. We are probably, I haven't talked to Joan about this yet, but I'm feeling a little, a bunch of different emotions tonight. Sad that it's over, excited that hopefully next season we'll all be back in the back room together where we can do it again, or who knows. The news does not bode all that great at the moment, but let's try to be optimistic and just really excited to be here one last time for the season. And thank you so much to all the readers and poets who have joined us this year, and everybody who's going to read tonight. Just an amazingly talented, incredibly varied group of writers. It's just been a pleasure to listen in and be a part of the work that's going on. It's really inspiring. Very. So thank you so much. And thanks to Joan, as always, for letting me hang out, unlocking the closet door, letting me out for the evening so I can talk to people and say hi. I'm not going to go on for much longer. I did want to thank one other person, and that person is Jimmy Sivetic, without whom none of us would really be here today doing this. Jimmy would probably hate that we were doing it this way. He would have us sitting in a park in the rain listening to poetry, probably, which might not be a bad thing. But I wanted to thank Jimmy and start off the finale here with one of Jimmy's poems. And this is called Bukowski in Heaven, by Jimmy Sivetic. A crazy dream. I met Charles Bukowski in heaven. He was sitting at a table with Jane, reading a poetry book. I didn't recognize the book, but it was a hardback with a blue cover. I asked him, "What are you reading?" He said, "My own work. Can't stand anyone else's." So I've been told. He had a small stack of his other books. I recognized them. Love is a Dog from Hell, Post Office, Factotum. Can I have one of those books? He said, "Take them all." I asked, "Can you sign them?" He signed the stack of books and handed them to me. "Thanks." He kept the one blue book, and I wanted to know about that blue book, but didn't ask. Not much of a poem here, except how he didn't like other poets. I thought, he is probably right about other poets. We made small talk about nothing of great importance, except writing is just putting the word down and the feeling of good, or almost feeling good, about writing. We knew without words, and I realized most would not believe this dream. And the dream was for my own understanding. I told him, "You were right. Sometimes you just have to piss in the sink." He said, "Two more fights, kid, and you take home the bacon." I walked away carrying the stack of books that he gave me and had a pretty good feeling about myself. I asked myself, "Dog, what do you know about truth? What do you know of wisdom?" Keats might have been right. Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. I woke from the dream and knew that I had to write a poem for a little while. And then I could go back to sleep. Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you for starting us off with that amazing piece. I want to go ahead and kick us straight into Veronica.
Hello. Thank you for that great poem, Chris. And thanks to Jimmy and for creating this HEMS legacy. Big thanks to Taylor and Anna and White Whale Books for just creating this amazing space for poets and poetry lovers. Grateful thanks to Joan and Chris for the invitation to share my work tonight. It's really an honor to read alongside Monica and Richard and Dan and Lawrence, and thank you. I'm gonna start off by reading some poems from a manuscript that I've been working on for 10, 11 years now called The Widow's Calendar. It chronicles my late husband, Mike Grimkowski's battle with cancer and the subsequent aftermath. The first one is called Think of the Maze and Gun Rooms. Think of La Bombonera Bakery. Think of the hundreds of kites flown on the fields as you enter El Moro. Think of the maze and gun rooms, the tunnels and spiral staircases. Think of the tiny turret that overlooks the ocean. Think of Pinkies and the drunken pilot omelet, earthy mushrooms, basil, spinach, and tomato. Think of the Mallorca sandwich with ham, fried eggs, Swiss cheese, cafe con leche, pastry dough dusted with powdered sugar. Think of the mangroves of Fajardo, the plankton that glow at night like underwater fireflies, chasing the movement of fingertips. Think of him swimming out to sea, struggling with a surfboard and the waves as he wrestles the water to find his center of gravity, his back burning a bright red in all the spaces where you have forgotten the sunblock. The face is a topographic map. The little orbits of the eyes, how one blinks and winks, closes the eyelids in sleep, squinches in pain. The muscles around the mouth form kissing muscles, smiling muscles, muscles that speak pleasure. I learn how to massage his cheeks and jawline by taking the forefinger and thumb, kneading the muscles around his mouth. My thumb, deep inside his mouth, meets the place where his jawbone begins. Thumb inside his mouth, in pointer finger alongside cheek, I pull the cheek and lips away from the jaw. I trace the underside of jaw, run my thumb along his gums. I didn't think there were parts of you left I had never touched. The lining of his cheek, smooth and supple inside, makes me think of the tenderness of lamb. The measuring. A married life is measured. Each grain of rice, coffee bean, and tea leaf, ice cubes crackling in a glass of water upon the nightstand, even the pinheads of steamed broccoli. Every hour of sleep lost when the baby is born, each hour you slept in before him, the time you say, I am going to remember this walk forever. The neon color of lichen after a long, hard winter, how your son wobbles, falls down, how you sweep him off the ground until you walk into the Social Security office, until you see the words printed in dot matrix, the date your marriage begins, the date your spouse dies, until you see what you did not know declared in writing, then you have a new language for this feeling, how your heart has become a singularity. Your marriage has ended in death. This last poem from this series is called When I Make a Map. of sorrow, and it begins with an epigraph by C.S. Lewis. I thought I could describe a state, maybe a map of sorrow. However, sorrow turns out to be not a state, but a process. When I try to make a map of sorrow, I think impossible. The state of sorrow is borderless, bigger than Rhode Island, maybe as large as Texas, depending on the day or weather, Alaskan in its wilderness. Sorrow, the widower writes, needs not a map, but a history. The road can continue forever, stretching along the highways, I protest, detailing every minuscule memory through the rest of my life, if I let it. As if I can hear him say, history is never history. Then I remember the Milwaukee airport, the TSA security area beyond the x-rays and metal detectors, a sign above me says recombobulation area. I have lingered here long enough, haven't I? Shall I gather my things, my papers, so to speak? The widower speaks directly to the widow and me. There is something new to be chronicled every day. It is time to cross over now, enter into a new country. So these last few poems I'm gonna read are, I have to thank Sheila Carter Jones and my fellow Mad Women in the Attic. Because I wrote these in workshop with Sheila and also my sisters of the hashtag Not White Collective for history and reclaim my cultural heritage as a Filipina American woman. And so this first poem is called Binasuan. I learned to dance the Binasuan by balancing a candle on my head, a candle in each palm. I am an octopus of light, turning my arms in helical spirals. I am the Monongahela monster lit up with neon green light, spinning its arms in the darkness of a summer night in Kennywood. This is a Pittsburgh poem. This is a Filipino poem. I have bobbled the light held inside a glass votive. I can bend down onto my knees. I can even lower my body down to the ground, roll like a rolling pin along the carpet, rise up to my knee until I am still standing again. Then I spin and spin and spin, arms outstretched, pivoting on the ball of my foot. I spin and spin and spin until I catch all the lights in one hand. And this poem is called Tinikling. The tickling bird steps and steps the traps you set in wetlands. Catch the bird you way you catch a fish, snap, snap, bamboo talons, trap and snap the bird inside the net. I dance like a bird tiptoeing through bamboo lances, smack, trap, the fleet, fleeting, the snap. I am a bird, the barred rail swift footed until I fly. And so, and this poem is called The Galleon. It was written, it's a section out of a longer poem written in response to an artwork at the Frick Museum last year. And I have to thank my friend Lisa for inviting me to write this poem. So, when I think of the ancient gold, I think of the present gold. When I think of the present gold, I think of the miner. When I think of the miner, I think of the conquistador. When I think of the conquistador, I think of the missionary. When I think of the missionaries and miners, I think of measles and chicken pox. When I think of measles and pox, I think of the Anamami. When I think of the Anamami, I think of the schoolboy with the fever and shortness of breath. I think of his chest pains. When I think of his chest pains, I think of his mother's broken heart. When I think of her broken heart, I see her mourning her son dead from COVID. When I see her mourning, I pray for this mother. I pray for all mothers. I pray for all mothers with sons on ventilators, for mothers with mothers in nursing homes, for the mothers in nursing homes. I pray for peace in the hearts of all mothers and their children. I pray for peace for Mother Earth, mother who says enough, mother who is burning. I pray for the Amazon and the trees and the Yanomami and the land that is being scorched into domestication. I pray for the animals who reveal themselves in the empty beaches, hatchling sea turtles as they crawl from sand to sea. I pray for the jackals that howl in the parks of Tel Aviv. I pray for the wild boar that descend into the streets of Barcelona and the whales that swim in peace along the Mediterranean, shipping lanes, graceful blue galleons of the deep. And this last poem was written as an introduction to the book, 100 Heroes, published by 412 for Food Rescue, and it honors the volunteers who've helped divert and rescue 44 million pounds of food since 2015 when the organization was founded. And so this is in thanks to also to Leah Lizarondo. Ode to 100 Heroes. Your stories constellate into a portrait of quiet heroism, undressed of capes and costumes, no helmets or shields, just heart full of boundless benevolence. You who courier compassion by foot, by bike, by truck and trunkfuls, you teach us how to make magic with time, transform lost opportunities into banquets of thanksgiving, how to forge kinship with kindness. With each rescue, you salvage the sun, wind, and rain, every element of every ingredient that grows from wildness into sustenance. With your hands, you tend the world into a place where everything created is never wasted. Dozens of gleaming red tomatoes, chartreuse bouquets of asparagus, the artichoke and aubergine eggplant, gallons of milk for growing children, even the long, slender tentacles of luscious aloe. You teach us how to remember our humanity by not forgetting our generosity. You illuminate the ways each small act of kindness born out of great love can make of this a brand new world. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, we live for you. We truly do. We are going to move to our next reader. Our next reader is going to be Richard. There we go. Okay, can we hear you, Richard?
Yeah.
Yay! Okay, you're all good to go.
All right, perfect. All right, I just want to say thank you to Joan. Thank you to Chris. I can't think of two bigger supporters of my work through the years. And thank you to Jimmy, of course. And it's such an honor to read with everyone who's here tonight. I'm big on introductions, so I'm just gonna get started here. This poem is called $500 Worth of Lottery Tickets. All right. All I want is a candy bar. I wait in line behind a drunk in shower sandals and dirty socks, spitting numbers so fast the clerk can't keep up. And when she gets a number wrong, he says, "Damn it, Helen, you're not listening to me." Outside, it's the first day, a winter coat isn't necessary. I'm playing hooky from work, drinking beers, wandering through the cemetery and kicking rocks down by the river. I should be working. The first of the month is a week away and bills, 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 blah, blah, blah. This guy knows though. The lottery drawing isn't for another 3 hours and he gets to spend that time thinking about everything he'd do with his Powerball nut. I know too, or at least I've learned, the only way people like us get to feel rich is to make ourselves poor. This one's called Divided Sleep. My therapist suggested I use these hours to bake pies or go for a run and release endorphins. Some people pulled a cork on a bottle of bourbon and drink it over chiming ice cubes in a dark kitchen, hoping to beat the sun. That works sometimes, but not enough. When I wake up and wade out into the deep end of the morning, careful not to stir my lover from her sleep, I swim into the living room and pull the blinds to a dead street, cold cars, and I'm always searching for a neighbor's light. Okay. And on we go to when my godmother tells me she'll cure her lung cancer with watermelon. I've been reading online, she says. Watermelon is full of lycopene, and that helps the cancer from growing. I love watermelon. What am I to say? I say nothing. Smoke gathers above us while she waves to neighbors rolling by in their Camrys. Maybe she's right. There's an infinite amount of content produced on a daily basis by freelance writers, shot out into space and back into our news feeds using sophisticated algorithms. Who's to say watermelon won't cure her cancer and heal her black toenails? I'm not going to. I'm going to sit here. The sun's shining, and when I leave, I'll say goodbye rather than see you later. Okay, how about some work poems? This one's called Bar Sinks. Back when we had enough days off to waste, and we'd spend them jacking our jaws in front of a Center Avenue pizza parlor owned by a couple of chain-smoking Turks, I'd always take the time to change the bar sink water mid-shift. Cold, greasy water doesn't clean the glasses. It leaves them frosted with lipstick and finger smudges. What was a few extra minutes then? We'd hair to lose, and legs like steel rods that pushed us through the weeds, a lifetime of martinis to stir. It's so easy to take pride in the work when you're young. Once your metabolism slows and you're shocked by a bald spot on your crown, pride doesn't matter. It takes too long, and I don't have the minutes. I collect them every night from clock in to clock out, put them in a glass. I never change the water anymore. I don't want to work 1 minute longer than I have to. Okay. We'll move on to a gambling poem. It's called Fury versus Wilder 2. I'm in a casino full of people. I am alone with God. Calling upon the Lord is an old reflex. It's the permanent bruise on my right hand from Sister Mary Arlene's pointer. The stories of the martyred saints are tattooed on my gray matter, and they tell the one story I hope is true, that all our pain and suffering eventually leads to unlimited reward. With $100 on the main event, I can't help but pray for a tiny advance. Our Father who art in heaven, fury by knockout, please, please, fury by knockout. Great. Let's read this one called Stanley Steamer. The matters of paperwork, legal documents complete with signatures, initials, notary stamp, only reveal a bread heel of reality. This has not been our apartment for months. It's a two-bedroom storage unit limbo where we've housed our mutual junk while we've separately surfed the couches of friends and coworkers, raided their linen closets and liquor cabinets. According to the government, we're still married, though I can't recall the last time we felt anything close to bliss. Per the lease, we were to have the carpets professionally cleaned before returning our keys to the rental office on Shady Avenue. So here I am with both sets in my pocket. Front door unlocked while the crew drags a gray hose from the yellow van and sucks 5 years worth of dog piss, nicotine from the shag, buried grains of rock salt ground in from our winter boots, brown pine needles from Christmas trees we thought we cleaned but somehow stayed woven in the fabric, the last of our combined skin particles stuck to the baseboards piled in corners. On the phone, they estimated this cleaning process would take an hour, maybe two. I know it will take much longer. All right, I think I got time for about 2 to 3 more. Bob Pajic wrote this poem about his cousin Ramey. He's a Pittsburgh poet, Bob, everybody knows him. And we met and I was like, you have a cousin Ramey, I have a cousin Ramey. And I read the poem again recently and I was inspired to write this poem. Dear God, it's called Cousin Ramey again. Dear God, please continue to bless all our cousin Ramies. Keep them at your right hand, for they do your work. They spend Saturday mornings watching wrestling with lonely boys, and they always have M80s in their corduroy pants pockets to blow up pop bottles and tree stumps in the woods for our entertainment. They drive us to the mall with sandwich bags full of quarters, enough to play Mortal Kombat for an hour and buy greasy food court egg rolls. Please bless them, for as we grow older, it's impossible for us to repay them. All right. This one's called Out of Ginger Beer. Sunday afternoons, I run out of everything. Take the keg of Guinness, another keg of Scott Ale, half a case of Gut Bomb tequila, because even at a Scottish pub, the sunshine calls for margaritas and Moscow mules. And I'm dreadfully out of ginger beer. There's no substitute for it. Ginger ale is too sweet, no bite. And I can't remember the last time someone ordered a Handsome Johnny. The sun clinks below the glass castle skyline like an Alka-Seltzer. The last elderly couple lingers over an order of fish and chips and talk to me about what the town looked like when the fires burned, like I'm too young to remember. I'm not. I remember all of it just fine, but it's my job to humor people. So I do, and pray for last call as the fruit flies swarm above our heads. And then the last one is called All the Iron City in Pittsburgh. If that fourth river bubbles to the surface and blows manhole covers into the partly cloudy skies of Allegheny County like flipped quarters, and all our Bubba's bones wash up from the clay, and we use them to build poker shacks in the woods and stir wilted cabbage, I know these same four guys will sit at the end of this bar playing along the Wheel of Fortune while I'm at the other end, hiding my face and praying the water takes us all away before anyone catches me here. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much, Richard. Yes. Thank you. We are going to go ahead and pass it right on over to Monica. There we go.
Hi, everyone. Hello. It's lovely to see you all. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so honored to be part of the Hemingway series. Okay. So I'm going to read three poems for you. I'm working on a Choria poem, which is a choreographed series of poems that focuses on love, sex, and polyamory, specifically how it shows up in Black women's lives. So I'm going to read one poem from that, and then I'm going to read a poem that I recently got accepted for publication, which is very exciting. And then I'm going to read a poem for my father. And that feels like a information for us all. Okay. So this first one is called She Loves, Second Person Plural. At first, it's uncomfortable to tell you I love you with an asterisk, to say you electrify my spirit, but you're not the only one. The concept of loving more than one body, so inappropriate, if not platonic. Romance is reserved for monogamy, singular beings choosing each other. I don't believe it. I can't. Not anymore. When I loved Matthew in eighth grade, I also loved Nick the whole time and long after. When I loved Evan in college, I wanted Ben and Travis and Leah, and I felt awful, guilty, mostly. Love, I thought, is supposed to be individual, the romantic kind anyway, no more than one at a time, or risk labels of cheater or slut. Fear kept me loving one man, Evan, even when he was lazy, even when he was mean, even when he so clearly was designed for oceans while I cannot swim. No surprise that while I tried to keep loving him, in entered resentment, a familiar shadow shaped like a jealous boyfriend. I went to Africa, like all Black girls eventually do. And as the marriage proposals rained like acid, Evan seethed across the graveyard of my ancestors, convinced that my love, so expansive and forgiving, would be stolen from him. He accused me for months after I started sleeping in American beds again. Who did you fuck over there? Don't tell me I'm crazy. I know you cheated. And I believed for a moment that love looked like suspicion and misplaced guilt, that because I was Eve's daughter, sin belonged to me first. When he tongued a stranger at a concert a year later, he asked for my jealousy. When he slept with a woman he didn't realize he'd fallen in love with, we're just friends, he said. She has a boyfriend anyway. He asked for my jealousy. When he fucked her again in the bathroom while I slept in his bed, my appearance unplanned, a surprise, he woke me to tell me what he'd done. And he asked for my jealousy. I gave him none. Why offer what I've always found boring, possessive, colonizing? I didn't tell him about the man who asked me to be his third wife, how, being the youngest, I'd be his favorite. He'd offered me 2 cows and several goats to my host mother for my hand, even after she explained I was not for sale. Américain, she kept repeating, meaning she does not belong to me. For 3 years after, I remained largely single, so disturbed by how resentment stole my orgasms and painted my fantasies with shame. One man told me the word then, polyamory, but he was married to 2 women who were sleeping together, each with a child wearing his crooked smile. Where would I fit into your life? I asked. I couldn't be someone's third wife. Here's what's beautiful. My love has always been selfish, wanting to be the center of attention, eager for more and more. A friend once told me I demand too much. No such thing, I countered. I'm proposing freedom, sex and communication and unbounded love. If one person cannot worship me, why not ask another? In the middle of my 20s, E said the word again, polyamory. And this time when I asked how I would fit, he rebuilt his whole world around me. We made love for hours, taking breaks to strategize the destruction of white supremacy. We held hands and made art and kissed and squeezed and salivated and worshiped our infinite selves. And when we weren't together, we found others who would build our temple with us for 3 years. I gave up my lovely soul to him, prepared to give him everything in exchange for a life wrapped in his evanescence. But here's the thing about the word. It makes you lazy. It made me put up with bad behavior, with neglect disguised as love. And I had to leave him before the love became resentment, became danger, became abuse. I left the man who defined my salvation, well, because it ultimately is mine. What I mean is this. I want stroke-like orgasms and someone to make tea when I'm sick and someone to dance with me until midnight and read silently on the other side of the bed and to hold hands in public and clean the kitchen while I go running. I want to choose my attention and get it on command. I don't want to compromise. I'll say it again. I don't want to compromise. I want my love to expand, to build a life of never-ending joy. Love is work, but it's not pain. It's not mediocre. Tell me I love you and know that when I say it back, I'm serious. But I don't mean only you. I mean you, second person plural. I mean you today and you tomorrow. I mean you when you can and me when you can't. Really, I say I love you, but I mean I choose me. You will never be the only one. We can be free together. We can be happy if you say yes to. So next poem, I have a prompt for my students where I ask them to write a poem from the perspective of a character in a game. And so I was playing a lot of Angry Birds at the time. So this is for Bomb, the Black Angry Bird. If any of you are fans, this is for him. So this poem is called Even in Cartoons, We're Scared of the Black One. You like me because I'm the black one, huh? Don't be ashamed. Pretty things often come in black. Designer sunglasses, sexy little dresses, people. When I'm available, I'm the most useful of the bunch. Bombs are like that, useful. You clearly appreciate my worth, my utility in battle. Do you know why they say never bring a knife to a gunfight? Destruction comes in black too. Gunpowder, cats, people. My power lies not in my rage. How basic, a bomb set off by anger, but in my fear. Surprise at underestimation or ignorance. No one ignores a bomb in your world, right? They devote entire squads to its diffusing, its disposal. In therapy, we learn to diffuse our anger, de-escalate tension with deep breathing and empathy. Do you empathize with me? A bomb disguised as a big black bird, as explosive ordnance, as crime in progress, as threat or danger to an officer. I mean, a pig. I mean, piggy that stole our right to due process. No, no, no. Trust in a fair system. No, no, no. Belief in serve and protect. No. Our sense of security. No. Freedom. No. Life. Our eggs. This is a game, after all. How does empathy cut the right wire to disable the countdown, unlight the golden fuse, settle shaken contents ready to explode? Don't make any sudden movements. Scare me, and I go off. All right, my last poem. Last semester, I made my students write a poem for every single day of the semester, which came out to 103 poems. So this is one of those. So this is called Father Poem. It's for my father. And it was based off of a prompt where we had to pull prompts from the beginning, the quotes that start and end Criminal Minds episodes. And this is one of those quotes, and it's by Anne Sexton. And it says, it doesn't matter who my father was, it matters who I remember he was. This is for my dad. My graduate school poetry professor, in an attempt to get a rise out of me, demands I bring her a photo of my mother before I was born. She wants to see who my mother was before she became my mother. It costs me nothing to look at her as a young woman. She looks like I did before college and trauma, save the large hair and even larger glasses. My professor believes she's done something to me when I send her the photo, that somehow seeing my mom before she was my mom would open a canyon in my heart, make me more amenable to criticism, and make me stop performing my poems. Unspeakable pleasure fills me when I say she chose the wrong parent. I suppose gratitude is due because without this exercise, alleged punishment, whatever, I may not have written entire books featuring pieces of my mother, frequently wise, always a survivor of many things, never angry or guilty. Had I found photos of my father, maybe this poem would have begun with him, so absent from my writing, sheltered from verses littered with rape and misplaced love. Maybe because I've always known he would be a father, certainly mine. His youth does not surprise me. Let's start again. In his photos, the smile is the same. A young Michael Jackson when he was still black, his afro still fresh. My father always planned on this life, married, successful children, semi-retirement somewhere warm. He was never absent or abusive, not an alcoholic or a gambler, church on Sundays, tennis on Saturdays, pickleball now for his knees. I don't believe I've been harmed by my parents for not loving each other. Yes, I'll admit it now. My mother wasn't supposed to be mine, anyone's. Nothing so dramatic as premarital sex, just a fact. She didn't want to be a mother. I imagine as much as she loves us, she planned on independence, love as a side street she intended to investigate briefly, but wound up with a lease in a new country. I wish I could see her in love, beaming at my father, ready to spend forever wherever suited them. But I can't picture it, can't even find the wedding album. This poem was about my father, how I remember him, though he's still alive. I have only images, no character voices the way my mother boasts in other drafts. Simply, learning to season food properly, doing laundry and ironing dress shirts, the plead of a cactus overwatered, his command over the road as we careen from state to state in search of colleges and futures. I promised I would give flowers before a funeral, before it's too late for apologies and forgiveness. So this poem is for him, my father, who I never doubted was mine, and who chose me intentionally, whose love rises up in me when I'm chopping vegetables or completing a spreadsheet. I fear poetry isn't enough. I fear I'll embarrass him with sentiment, but I know I never feared him, this man, wholly consuming and bold, an image of solid gold against a darkening sky. No, never, not once. Thanks, y'all.
I'm doing the round of applause. That was so great. Thank you so much, Monica. Thank you, thank you. Next up, we are going to have Daniel. Let me go ahead and get us together. There we go. And make sure you can do your video.
All right, we're good. Thanks a lot, Taylor and the White Whale family. I'm happy to be wearing the White Whale shirt today, and I've got my poet hat and I've got a drink for Hemingway. I think I'm covering everything. Thanks so much as well to Chris and Joan. And I think that I have a good segue from what Monica finished with. I find that I've been reflecting a lot. Been in the house so much, and my parents were supposed to come and visit in a couple days, but they had to cancel because they're concerned about about COVID. So I thought I would talk about my hometown a little bit, which is Rochester, New York, which I think is actually pronounced Rochester, but I don't really have the accent anymore. I try to do the accent at times, but it's I haven't lived there in a while, but so in Rochester, the biggest star when I was a little kid was Chuck Mangione. Well, he was the biggest star everywhere for a while. And I started to go back and find all his video, like these old videos and songs. And I sort of wrote about my childhood through him, through kind of writing to him in ways. So the first few poems I'm going to read are about him, kind of, and about a bunch of other things too, of course. The titles don't really make sense because it's sort of still a work in progress, but this one is called Feels So Good, Part One, because his big hit song was Feels So Good. The older people who are here know about this. The younger people, Google, look them up. So anyway, Feels So Good, Part One. This song did not teach me how to love, but how to take stock of it. What a man looks like when he no longer cares what he looks like, when he hugs a horn, a life preserver. This song is 9 minutes, 43 seconds of men daring boys to embrace the necessary opposite of dead end 70s macho. On Love's album cover, the letters of our feelings can't stand up straight. They rest on a shoulder dyed red as a Valentine. Love is the soft hands that caress pork pie hats, reshape them into signatures. I took stock of love in F major, a subconscious guitar pedal marking time. Closing in on 8 years old, I dipped my boots into snow, no pain in the exploding whiteness of a heart-warmed winter. Chuck Mangione, Part Two. There was that time when Chuck Mangione taught us how to play the trumpet and flugelhorn in 4 minutes. He wore a shirt made of stars, a hat of love's warm underbelly. He pointed at parts of instruments, bell, mouthpiece, valve, mute. But we looked away and listened to him speak in a voice we grew up hearing, that of a longtime Rochesterian, perhaps one of our grandparents' friends who would invite us in for some sort of salad, red dusted deviled eggs, and we would always leave happier because we had learned something new, like Pinochle, or what their adult children were doing, or why some jokes work better than others, or that they once knew a man who could sit in an empty auditorium talking about blowing air into brass, how a small story could lift them over days when they just didn't know. Chuck Mangione, Part Six. A stranger said something mildly bad about Rochester the other day. I don't remember what it was, perhaps just the usual surprise our hometown is, quote, not that terrible, quote, close quote. and I didn't speak up. We're reminded that staying silent amid injustice enables injustice. If you'd been there, Chuck Mangione, you would have found a way to write that person, to serve up the beauties of our city, the beauties of you, all the joys, all the messes, a garbage plate come to life. Most people cannot wrap a lifetime into one note played on a horn, a note that might even be flat, because love is not an easygoing white Christmas. Love is a snowbank stained by exhaust. It's introducing everyone to your family, even to the uncle who needs to update himself, because when you pretend not to love a place that lets you lie in its tall grass for years, a place that still stays gray the way you like it, you become that best friend on the weekend who rode all the rides with you at Seabreeze, but at school on Monday tells the popular kids you're ugly or fat or, God forbid, different. Think of the real friend who lets you cry later, the friend who, like you, cherishes the sun and the 300 days without it. The rest of the poems I read, I'm going to read are from my book. This is not a mixtape for the end of the world. This book, all the poems in it are sort of commentary on 80s pop music videos, and they kind of address all the feelings I had growing up in the 80s, kind of. So the first poems I read were kind of before I really understood much about life, and you know, I could still listen to Chuck Mangione all over the place. And then this is kind of, you're starting to make sense of things. You see sort of the artifice, the fear of nuclear war, fear of AIDS. There were all kinds of issues that we had to face. Nostalgia, I don't know what you really call it looking back at all of this, but so the titles of these poems are all sort of snippets of lyrics from songs. And then the first one's actually from a Rick Springfield song, Affair of the Heart. So I watched the music video and sort of put some things together based on that. And the title is Made to Be Played by My Hands. Everyone besides you learns to look in the mirror for reflections of what they've never been. You see only the horror of a pretty face that won't change. You wake from a nightmare, take the four-measure pause to believe what you lived wasn't real. You peek through the blinds to pinch yourself, but glimpse a tiger, a stereotype. To give back to the fans, you let women pose for pictures with your childhood. You smile as they run their fingers through what's left of REM sleep. You let go of the accent as if it were your first love. You can't talk in dreams because a guitar solo screams through your mouth. Your wax figure O. You know mirrors hide what it means to be alone because people laugh at you on the other side, people who reflect. You see the most of yourself in what you lose. This poem is called We're in Our Never Splendor, which is a line from the Culture Club song, I'll Tumble For You. This video is sort of a horrifying music video to me, and it just kind of tied into a lot of my memories of maybe watching the news in the 80s or something, I don't know what, but they invite you to a variety show. You're overcome with admiration as you watch everyone warm up. Fire eaters, unlit run-throughs, jugglers, tosses of turned off chainsaws. Stay backstage, they say. As a white swan pas de deux ends, they say, now it's your turn, push you onto the stage. You start to walk off and they say, don't make us show you what happens to the losers. You're about to ask what you're supposed to do when the piano player starts to play Boogie Woogie and nods at your feet. You don't know how you were outfitted with tap shoes, don't know how the bandy twists and barrel rolls come so easily. The audience nearly drowns out your sound, but restrains itself enough to hear the rhythms you had held inside for your whole life. As your feet continue to move, you know you must be a winner. You try not to think about what will happen to the sword swallowers and unicyclists, but you love to win. This is called Of All the Suburban Dreams from the Pet Shop Boys song, Suburbia. You start each sentence with before, a nod to the nostalgia of people who act like they didn't win. You picture a city without crime, a city with more people who speak your language. In books, the hardest choice used to be what hat to wear, which vegetable paired best with which meat from a once living being. You love the highway bypass high above the city, the route that avoids check cashers, tax preparers, furniture rentals. There's so much to skip between work and home. 20 minutes from the city, your neighborhood comforts you with dogs that roam the streets, dogs that feast on unfinished business. You retire to the safety of home, the living room surrounded by boxes you won't open. The downtown you boarded up, the communities you filed under after, they know everyone by name, know whose backs to watch. This is the last poem. It's actually the last poem in the book. It's slightly hopeful, which I thought was necessary. It's from the Crowded House song, Don't Dream It's Over. So the title is, We Know They Won't Win. Okay. In the intro, he shrugged at friends who called him a savior, knew they had confused the testaments. His band should have been done in by plagues, note cards, frying pans, chicken on a stick that rained for days. He calmly walked through the house of verses, exercising with acoustic guitar and floating head. Tropospheric dinner plates would shatter, first on the roof, later against the brazen openings of windows. He suggested they do chores until the storm passed, wield irons to smooth out shirts and ghosts. When he got to the last room, the final measures of song, he whispered in the drummer's ear, hold all my calls. Finally, he could set down the guitar, open the door to a projectile-free outro, stride into a meadow that reached to the end of the decade. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yes, I love the claps. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you so much. Next up, we're going to hop right into Lawrence. Let me make sure. Excuse me, you're all good to start your video. Yes, let me make sure to spotlight you. There you go. Oh, make sure to unmute, Lawrence.
Thanks.
There you go.
What an incredible reading. It's really wonderful to be a part of this group. And I thank you, Taylor, and White Whale, and Joan, and Chris, and everybody who's been a part of making such a special time here. So I'll just jump in. I have four poems to share. This first one is called Xanthos. These were our immortal horses, five wild cream-colored Mustangs let loose in the dirt rink. The point of the West is mastery, the rivers dammed for arid cities, the sheer open, unending ocean's expanse for a rodeo's small prairie. They were captured in high desert, the show for cowboys to rope them. Manes flared in the burly rush, lariats whipped out, but one horse, a god, rearing and kicking, still ran free when the others were taken. So another cowboy threw in, the two ropes sprung taut, cinched its neck, and the Mustang flailed, arced up and out, and was pulled down hard. People gasped and stood. A fervid quake rippled its coat sheen from withers to flank and stifle. It lay, and my grandfather looked on me, a helpless, sorry softness in his eyes. We saw the cowboys dismount. For a long time, they stood around its radiant figure, its neck broken. A canvas tarp was unfurled, and the dust, his eyes never like that as it was tucked under the horse. We heard a tractor engine turn over, a wide gate, as it was walked open, screeched, and the horse he and I never spoke about was dragged out. This second poem is another Central Arizona poem. It's called The Names. From Heber Overgard, the drive turned quiet as we passed the small firs. The meadow had been reached by two fires one June, and I was turning over the names Rodeo and Chedisky, the first two ranges burnt. The Mogollon calls to mind a prior and current people. Their markings are a riddle to me, though I want to read for hours, listen for silent departures. I broke in. What are you thinking? I'm trying to remember, she said, who you walked to school with. Repeating the names after me, she recognized each one, a gentle surprise as if the faces restored us momentarily to some lost portion of ourselves. Like the emerald hummingbird when we were out walking. It flashed in front of her face, her lips always so like a flower, that vibrant tone of red I used to watch her put on as she leaned close to the mirror. It left instantly as our time, all our time together, driving. Out on the forest road, no one in sight. The ponderosas tall where nothing had burnt. The sky a vast cerulean dome. The road itself an enclave like the name Heber to join, to bind for those who go. Overgard signals the farmstead, the upper pasture. Here is my dual heartedness. I turn to stay or try to stay with her on home ground, but cross it like fire consumes, like wind defines all our reunions, that unbroken rivering we hear 100 feet up. And this next poem is called Unavoidably Fugitive, and it's a Pittsburgh poem about a nearby park. Hang on, I need a drink. I want a map that's hummed and meanders. Who knows where we'll go, Emily, a piece of bread in hand. No bed to sleep in like the fabled girl, but out, walking. Being given the thin linen of starlight for a broken open heart, if starlight falls on us. Here, a hillside called Linden Grove, where there are no lindens to find, I've turned off the location of my device. We may shed all hems and caches. The star field of dream may be revealed, like people walking out of mist, emerge first as dark, slender, solitary trees. A composer said she hears cross the field something eerie, the scritchy strings of brittle winter weeds. Let the signs we leave behind be unavoidably fugitive. I want to orient in the unretraceable present, leaf rag, grass that squelches at having to carry a body across, a map that's breathed and dissolves on cold air, new every moment, marked by chirps, whistles, rustles, wing beats, by acorn falls and deer too late. Hyreth, the Welsh say, for a place we haven't been and long to return to, where a tree might be given a name, Chris Emmons' oak, the one coming up this very hill, he sat to rest by and died at 24 on a Saturday in late August, and maybe felt again where dusk already tucks in. Wandering into a patch of wild mint, given nothing more than vibrant, alert, and unfinished nature, a sweet aroma lifts as he goes. I just want to say again, before I read this last one, what a pleasure it is to be here. I'm grateful to all the readers and all the wonderful poems I've heard. This poem is called Windfall. The splotchy, rumpled ground beneath the bird feeder stays chestnut and fallow. Leaf debris uncovered during the snowfall where seeds drop, an abundance, where squirrels find shells, kernels still intact within the circle. As I hope this midwinter turns out to be for you, one defined by the whistly tremolo of mourning doves, escaping some urgent call for lower branches, and not the pulse of a monitor marking your time, and not at your bedside, a colorless fluid as it issues into a vein. So let us keep this place open. I love the grass that bristles the bed of snow around the scatter. In a little while, it too will be covered as evening comes on. I love the gentle swing of the feeder with its crew of chickadees, and beneath the bare laden patch, visited while the light was good, as if tending to this time of risk keeps the circle intact. I see you standing where the seed falls. Thanks.
Yes. Yes, as Joan mouthed, wow. Thank you so much. Thank you to everybody for such an amazing reading. Let me go ahead and, there we go. Joan, I wanted to offer you the floor before we do our open for everyone. If you all want to continue to stick around, we are going to ask you all to, you know, say your pieces towards the end, but definitely want to give Joan the floor.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. There are people in our audience whom we've seen, I think, every week. I think we've seen, and I must say, just shout outs to all of you who have been here with us, Ganjel, Maxine, Rick, Sheila, I mean, so many folks whom I see, Michaels, Sims, great to have you with us listening tonight. A big shout out to Jill and Adlai, Anna, Halsey, and Taylor. Yay, Taylor. okay. and of course to Chris for, you know, for that beautiful rendering of Jimmy's poem about Bukowski, and for just the great introductions every week, and for helping, you know, so to be a partner with him, crafting this series, bringing in voices we often had really not heard before. I mean, this has been, there's been a blessing in this, that we have been able to hear people reading, not from a back room, but from kitchens and campgrounds and campuses and alcoves and back porches from all over the country. And frankly, people we couldn't have as easily brought together. So that's been wonderful, and we'll just have to see about next year. I want to do a shout out and give Rich a chance to say something as well, if he'd like, about nightlifeline.org. But Night Lifeline, the effort to raise money for people who are entertainment or in restaurant service or the people who work in kitchens or working stages. They have raised over $50,000. Their goal is $100,000. I believe they've already started dispersing some funds. So I don't know. Rich, do you want to come in here and say anything about that for a minute?
I absolutely would. And I want to thank you and Chris for advertising this and pushing this throughout the Hemingway Summer Reading Series. And it's a blessing because the Hemingway series is so important to me and to writers around the city. But Nightlifeline started in November of 2020. We were all asked to come together and speak at a press conference that Sarah Enamorato hosted. And we all realized that so many different workers from so many different industries were there, and we all, our industries all interact with one another. So restaurants get more business from live events. Live events foster artists who need paid, and everybody was out of work. I mean, March 2020 was so bad. I can tell you, I worked the night that Governor Wolf shut down, and it was truly incredible. And this year has been, this year plus has been full of immense changes, and workers in the nightlife ecosystem have been hit the hardest of all. We've been stuck in an antiquated unemployment compensation system where people are waiting for money that they're owed. You see it recently now with the CDC eviction moratorium that just got renewed. These are people in, whether it's the restaurant industry, live event industry, who are still trying to catch up on their rent. Yeah. And so we've attempted, and we have raised over $50,000. We distributed our first funds to 50 nightlife workers in need back in June. That was the first round, and we're making the push for the next round. And even though people have gone back to work, live events have dragged on. They're just starting. People who've worked in restaurants are still trying to catch up to back where they were. And this is a new normal. It's not normal. It's a new normal. And so people are still figuring out how to navigate that. And they still need help to get back and to be made whole on what they were before this happened. And so I really appreciate if everyone would visit nightlifeline.org, check out what we are about, and perhaps if you have the money to donate a little bit as we try to distribute our second round of funds.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I just want to also, I'm going to thank our readers tonight who are just amazing. This whole series has been so great. And we got to hear about discombobulation, the discombobulation area, which I thought was a very good way of describing that experience. The watermelon cure, which I hadn't heard about before. Gambling and martyred saints. Selfish love. Polyamory. Rochester, Chuck Mangione, and Meadows, and beautiful poems of place. This is just an extraordinary evening. And we thank you all. And why don't we open up so people can say yay. And again, thank you to White Whale. We couldn't have done it without them. We would have been stranded.
Yay. Well done, everyone.
Yay.
More than yay. Wonderful, wonderful. Every single word you wrote meant everything.
Bravo.
Angel.
Thank you, White Whale. I've been through a couple of these and fabulous. I really feel the community.
Yeah.
Thank you, all of you, all the poets and Owen and Chris and White Whale. It was wonderful, as usual.
Thank you all so much. It was a great evening.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Joan, thank you for advertising this and everything you do. I'm always following you. You know that. It's like, what's going on? Joan knows. Thank you.
Well, sometimes, and sometimes she even spells the names right, but not always. Okay.
That's all right.
And then she asked where you were at. Who was?
Well, thank you all.
Enjoyed the reading. Enjoyed the reading. Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
You take care, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
You too, Joan. Bye.